my presentation is sort of taking us back and down to the individual girls and women who are in need of meeting encounters with healthcare services. And I, to tie up to the medicalization topic, I am suggesting that rather than healthcare providers performing FGM and thereby contributing to the continuation, focus should be on care for complications from the practice. And care for complications from the practice or consequences of the practice can help to improve the health and well-being of girls and women with FGM, those 133 million who already have it and the numbers that are increasing. At the same time, it can also help to reduce or to undermine the practice of FGM, is my theory. And that's why I'm also very happy for the whole conference topic, because so much focus has been on prevention, and one often tends to forget or bypass all those women who already had undergone the practice. So my presentation is based on the study that I'm in the middle of doing, and not many people, at least medicals, do preliminary findings, but it helps me to think out loud and it helps to focus on other aspects of healthcare. Also, I think a focus on my study is to look at, to sort of focus a little bit back on the individual, because a lot of the preventive work on FGM over the last few years focused very much on social norms. But there are individuals who decide against social norms, and individuals are also the ones who can change social norms. So we have to get them also back into the site. Healthcare providers can have many roles with regard to FGM, and the most common focus in FGM work or anti-FGM work is that healthcare providers should be trained to get the knowledge about the health complications so that they can convince women to stop FGM, because they have the knowledge and they have the social authority. But as has been discussed, is that there is a theory that the focus on the health risks is one of the reasons why healthcare, why parents or guardians go to the healthcare services to have doctors or midwives or nurses perform FGM. So this has contributed to the medicalization. And this is also one of the major reasons why it is said that the focus on FGM work has changed from health risk to a focus on human rights. At the same time, this is a challenge, because the reason why it is a challenge to human rights is that it is a health risk. So you cannot sort of get away from the health issue. So my main focus here will then be on what the care that healthcare providers can provide, and that this can contribute to leverage abandonment. Not only to improve health and well-being, which is important and a human right and an ethical obligation in itself, but also to undermine the whole practice. One aspect of this, that by providing proper care for women in FGM is to, and to girls and also, is that you can have reduced resistance against the messages, because they can understand better that you are working on this topic because you care and not because you are trying to enforce another cultural value or undermine their own cultural values. And many people who are working on the field have telling me that they feel very embarrassed when they go out to tell people about the health risks and that they should stop FGM, but they cannot offer care for those who have complications with it. Secondly, it's very important as a way to get data, because there is data, as we saw in the first session, on health complications, but these are often general and they're not specific to the community and might not be considered relevant for the community in which you are working. And the actual data which are from your neighborhood, from your community, can be more convincing and more realistic according to the type of FGM or the setting in which it's practiced. But the most important thing that I will focus here is that it can help undermining the practice. And in a way, the theory of, which is the title of Fowler's book, is that if you can undo FGM, you undermine the whole reason why doing it in the first place. My focus is from Norway, where the main practice is defibrillation. We do not have a clitoral reconstructive surgery, but we have a high number of women with defibrillation who needs defibrillation. And the study came about with some data from a study I did 13 years ago, and some of the stories that people told me in that study and that I've been carrying with me. And it's the very different perceptions in the community against defibrillation. And now I'll tell some of the stories. So, for example, there was one woman who was actively engaged in work against FGM. She had two daughters who were infibulated. The mother said this happened prior to migration to Norway. The daughter said it happened on a trip home. But whatever the reason or the context it happened, one of the girls had severe health complications from her infibulation and had been strongly advised by medical doctors to defibrillate to ease the complication. But for the mother, there was no way she could allow defibrillation. She think this would be a high risk for her. She would never be able to marry or be accepted in the community. So I felt that however much she was against the practice, she felt the social norm or the fear of what could happen to her daughter hindered her from seeking this health care. The second story was a young woman, and actually with healthcare training, who had also health complications from infibulation and was advised to have defibrillation, but it took her many, many years, and I followed her through all these years, that she considered and reconsidered whether she actually had the courage to go through the defibrillation. And when she actually did so, she expressed that she was so surprised to feel that she felt the same person. She had feared that once being defibrillated, she would crave sex at any time with anybody, and was scared of losing self-control, sexual self-control. So in a way, it shows also that this is not just social expectation. This was integrated in her perception or expectations of herself. The third story was a man in his 50s. He was about to marry his third wife. He had stayed in Norway for around 20 years, and none of his daughters had FGM, he said. He had been strongly against it. But when he wanted to pick a wife, a new wife, he went to his home country, and he said there was no way he could have a wife without infibulation. He would not be able to trust the sexual conduct of a woman who had not been sutured. So this also that you can have a different perception of your wives and your children, and that some have the other way around. And finally, sort of what really inspired this study was the story of a young woman who had, she had a very sort of special role in Norway. She was very active. She was doing things which were not considered acceptable by her family, and she had been sent home for infibulation. And the moment she came back to Norway, she went to the hospital and had surgery to be defibrillated. And this is the type of cases that I have been curious, how many of these young girls is it that sort of want to remove it immediately in a context that is maybe not a traditionally accepted context. So I'm, as I said, in midway in the study. I do qualitative interviews and focus group and participant observation. And so I'm still collecting data. What is also, what is interesting is that I'm interviewing Somali women and Sudanese men mostly so far through networking. And these social networks have gained mostly contact with overprevalence of highly educated people who have a different background and story. But I also have access to refugees who have, what do you call them? Overferings. Refugees who are collected from refugee camps. And I interviewed the ones who interviewed them in the community and when they arrive and they're settled in the small villages all over Norway. So some of them have been here just a few months at the time I interviewed them. So we had a wide variety of residents and background, and they also generally have very low education and rural background. So just before I go into the data, we made an estimate of the number of girls and women with FGM in Norway, and based on prevalence in the country they come from, and age at which cutting usually happen, and the age at immigration, we have estimated that we have around 17,500 girls and women with FGM. That means some of these are young girls. In countries where FGM happens between 1 and 3 years, we estimate that above 3 years, the prevalence is the same like in the youngest group. And I think that's also often forgotten, that you have a lot of children with FGM, and the focus it's not only on prevention, but on care for the girls. And actually, it's interesting because we have this large number of migrants compared to our small country. So our national prevalence of FGM is actually 0.7%, which means we are almost like Uganda and Cameroon and some African countries. Our migration pattern means we have a high population. Almost half of the migrants from affected communities are of Somali origin, 19% of Eritrean, and 3% of Sudan, and these are the countries with high prevalence of type 3 FGM. So they constitute altogether more 60% than the affected population. And most focus in Norway has been on this type of FGM. We have in the country 8 regional clinics, university hospitals and other hospitals that have specialized competency in dealing with complications from FGM, but again, a special focus on defibrillation. And some hospitals, women can search direct help, and some they have to be referred by others. And we estimate very, very, very roughly that about 1,000 girls have sought help in total since 2004 until 2014 in these clinics. The surgical procedures mostly offered is, or some of the surgical procedures, mostly defibrillation and said, and we also have cyst removal or other type of repair of damage, but we do not have clitoral reconstruction. That has been controversial both in the medical sector and in the affected communities. So, just shortly, what is different from this? In countries where they have infibulation, of course, you have to do defibrillation at certain stage. You need to defibrillate to be able to have sex. You need to defibrillate when you deliver. And there are different ways in which this is done in different countries. The traditions vary. Sometimes it's the exciser who do it. Sometimes it's the husband who does it. And also the extent and the type differs in countries. But what is special then with the hospital defibrillation in Norway? Of course, that is done medically with pain relief, and then there are stitching to the side to hinder regrowth, whereas in the traditional context, you are supposed to have repeat sexual intercourse to ensure that the opening stays open. Husband and wife, or they are told not to have sexual intercourse until the wound is healed, like 6 weeks or so. But the new thing is also that defibrillation is carried out in other situations than at marriage and at childbirth. It is carried out as a treatment for various health complications, such as painful intercourse and periods, and is also carried out on pregnant women to facilitate childbirth. And then, like the last story, there are some young girls with no plans of marriage who seek defibrillation just to get rid of their FGM, sort of. So my study then tries to look at to what are the motivation for women and what is the sociocultural acceptability of these type of surgeries. To what extent is it a matter of improving health? And improving health is a main motivation, especially to reduce pain and childbirth, but also many women were not aware of the health benefits they could achieve. So they went through defibrillation either as a part of childbirth or as a preparation for childbirth, and come back and we're very relieved of that they have facilitated sexual intercourse, is no longer painful, and other parts of their life became easier. Then you have the other aspect is this is a norm change, or is it just individual women changing their bodies through surgical procedures individually and hiding it, or is it a norm change that this is acceptable or supported practice? And it seems like, for me, a huge variation between social circles. You have social circles where this is definitely socially acceptable and talked about and open, and social circles where this is very silent, and some women who had stayed in Norway for 10 years or more were not even aware that they could have these surgeries, and when they found out, still said they could never have done it because they would have been scared that they would not be acceptable in marriage or not morally acceptable. So, another issue is that the challenge of health, seeking this for health risk, which I forgot to say, is that there's a lot of the health complications from FGM that are so naturalized that people are not aware of it. So you have also people coming to the center saying they have absolutely no health complications from this, and when they ask, how often do you urinate, how long does it take, do you dribble between, do you have pain, they have all these complications, but consider it as a normal. So it's also a training awareness session in doing the examination and doing the care. But the final then is that like the young woman who went immediately to defibrillate, is that a story that individuals do as an individual reclaiming of the body, a little bit like this talked about the clitoris surgery. And among the women I interviewed, only 2 of them had done this defibrillation prior to finding any engagement or any husband, and they definitely saw it as taking control of their body and being in charge of their body. And what I find interesting, though, one of them had been in foster care when this happened, so she was not living with her family, The other one lived with, she was grown up actually. But they are a little bit on the margins of the community. They are socially accepted in the community. They are socializing with others. Some are married with others from the same community. But they are also more integrated and taking some more critical stance to their own community. And that's what led me to the final argument, is that I feel that a lot of the interventions on FGM is focused very much on top-down, on an idea that you tell religious leaders and they will convince others, or you tell health personnel and they will convince others. But in the diffusion of innovation theory from Rogers, who is similar to the other theories of change, he's suggesting that the ones who change first are the ones on the margins. It's the ones who are not 100% integrated or who are rebellious or question other things in the community as well. And from what I saw from these young women who did defibrillation before marriage, they are a little bit of this rebellious type. And the question is then, how can you use that force to stimulate change and spread it with inside the community? And how can the changes happening in Europe, where you have these healthcare services, also affect back home what is happening there? Thank you.
What I have identified from the different presentations, it is from the first presentation, it is about the education level and healthcare level. Education level, we can ask the question about, you know, what is the role of primary school to prevent this FGM, you know, and this school, primary school, are able, for example, to teach what does it mean child human right, you know. Okay, I think it is a question mark for education sector. And because if the girls and women have no knowledge about their human rights, how they will be able to apply it, you know. Donc that it is the first question. It was mentioned about, you know, the importance of the curricula, to have a curricula in the university. I think it is so important, you know, point. Have been mentioned, and the question is who will be able to lead this process, you know, at the university, at the national level, to develop this curricula and as well to involve the other public health schools, you know, or research center and so on. And in terms of training for the nurses, midwife, and doctors, it will be as well consider, I know for the Anglophone countries, CPD, you know, continuum professional development, you know. I think it is critical to have this continuation, you know, for the message. And the question about that, at national level, who will be able in charge of monitoring and evaluation, I think we forget this part of monitoring and evaluation, because, you know, you can put in place many interventions, but who are in charge or able, you know, in terms of resource, budget, you know, human resource and so on, to do the evaluation, you know, and to evaluate the gap, you know, and the impact. That it is very important question. We know, for example, for African countries, we have this issue for all the policies because, you know, the investment in research is not enough, and specifically to evaluate the intervention. We you know, it's not enough at the Ministry of Health in terms of budget. Donc, how the international community as well can be involved on this part, on the monitoring and evaluation, you know, of the intervention, that it is another question. And how to as well stimulate international community to have more research, you know, related to all the questions need to be answered about this issue. You know, that it is another important point. And as well, for the healthcare level, it will be interesting to know what is the role of the doctor, you know, in their curricula to really prevent this FGM, you know, how that will work at national level, specifically for the country with high level of rate, you know, of these practices. Donc we can as well mention from WHO, for example, the possibility to establish a checklist, you know, in terms of the evaluation of this type of practices, specifically in the healthcare services. And another strategy can be to use maybe patient-centered approach, have been promoted by WHO, for example, and not, you know, as usual, I will say medical approach, you know. And as well to consider patient safety and security as well in terms of framework. And it was the part for healthcare level. I have identified as well the issue about, you know, health systems level. It was mentioned very well for the second presenter about you have big discrepancies between different countries, you know, because as it was mentioned, the level of the health systems is not the same. For example, in Kenya, Egypt, and Nigeria, we know it is better than, for example, Francophone countries like Mali, you know, Mauritania, and so on. Donc, we have an influence of the quality of the health systems, you know, as well about the quality of care, and specifically, we can see when you have, I will say, low level of quality of care, it is more apparently done by the traditional healer, and if the health system is better, apparently it is more delivered by health provider. That it is what I have seen from the figure. And donc I think that it is important to consider as well, for example, for Kenya, the aspect of urbanization and what is the prevalence of FGM in the city and in rural area. I think we have big discrepancy and we have not seen the data here about these disparities. And it was mentioned today about the issue of ethnic groups. I think we have some country like Burkina Faso, for example. We have, it's an example, many different ethnic groups. Donc, we have not the same prevalence inside the country. I can give you just an example. Recently, I got from our discussion on the forum, Francophone forum. It was, and we exchanged with the Anglophone experience. It is the case of Tanzania, because you have mentioned the individual, you know, change and social change from the community. I can give you an example. In Tanzania, for example, women supported by the community have decided to, because the FGM apparently was used specifically to go through to the adult age. And she, with the support of the ethnic group, because it was specific tribal group, in fact, The girls have decided to remove these practices and change these practices by an object, you know, the symbol of, you know, when you go through the adult age. Donc, it's a very interesting case how one individual with the social community, as you have mentioned, can change, you know, the behavior of the entire group. I think that can be as well interested to know why they do it for each specific ethnic group, for example, because the reasons are totally different, and what are the root cause, in fact, of this type of practices, you know. And for the last level I have mapped, it is about the policy level. Donc, how we will be sure, you know, at policy level, again, the intervention will be implemented. Big question mark. We know for sure when the law is established, it is very difficult for the application of this law. How the people will go through the process, you know, to apply this right. If they have not the knowledge from the primary school, how they will do it, you know, if they are ignorant, you know. It is as well associated to the condition, to the level of poverty, and it was very well mentioned as well. Okay, I think, again, we need to consider a lot of different factors, you know, together in the same time to have better impact on this issue. Thank you.